This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Take a second and walk over to the nearest sink and just turn it on for just a moment. Instantly, you get a cool, clean, seemingly endless supply of drinkable water. But of course, you don't just drink the water. You clean your dishes with it, you bathe with it, you water your lawn, you hose off your car, you freeze it into cubes, and you boil it for tea. And you probably don't think much about it at all. If you live in drought-stricken California or near the Elk River in West Virginia, you might have a different relationship with water today. But for us in the Northeast, it seems the tap will never run dry. Today, where we live, water. How it gets here, how we use it, and how to make sure we'll have enough. First, a bit of the history. The ancient Romans constructed a complex system of underground channels and elevated aqueducts capable of carrying quantities of water comparable to what we use today. Rome's urban water system established what author David Sedlak calls the first water revolution, or Water 1.0. According to Sedlak, it's one of three such revolutions that's taken place in the past 2,500 years or so. As we face issues of climate change and population growth, he says, we may soon see a fourth. Today, Sedlak joins us from California to talk about his new book, Water 4.0, The Past, Present, and Future of the World's Most Vital Resource. Coming up later, we'll be joined by our local water expert, Virginia DeLima, and we'll also hear from reporters from West Virginia Public Radio to give an update on the January Elk River chemical spill, which left nearly 300,000 residents without access to safe drinking water. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. If you have questions or thoughts about how we get our water here in Connecticut. You can also email us where we live at WNPR.org, and you can join us online at WNPR.org, where we've got a webpage going with a conversation about today's show. First, I'd like to welcome in David Sedlak. Once again, his book is Water 4.0, The Past, Present, and Future of the World's Most Vital Resource. He's professor of civil and environmental engineering at UCAL Berkeley, and he joins us from their studios today. David, welcome to our program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, good morning, John. Thank you for having me.
As we start our conversation, I really do want to get back into the history and go where you began with the Romans. Tell us a bit about how they got water to their people, how they got water to their cities.
Well, maybe more important than how they got water was why they needed so much water. Mm-hmm. The Romans were some of the wealthiest people in the ancient world, and they lived in a city that had a lot of people. And when you have a lot of people, you quickly overwhelm the ability of the local environment to provide you with a water supply. So they had the Tiber River running through the city. They had local groundwater. But quickly, when the city grew to a population of about 500,000 people in 300 BC, that wasn't enough for them. And so they had to bring in water. And they brought in water from distances of up to 50 miles away. And they built, at the height of the empire, as much as 250 miles of aqueducts. And by aqueducts, we mean underground passages with these short lengths of elevated aqueducts that we see on all the picture postcards. And that water came into the city and provided not only drinking water, but water for the Roman baths, water for fountains, water for recreation, and water for washing down the streets. And so at the height of the empire, people had a huge supply of water coming in from a long distance, and it was all fed by gravity, and it didn't need much attention at all.
When you talk about the water for recreation, they used lots of water to stage mock battles and things like this?
Oh, sure. I mean, just like the Colosseum was a place where they had gladiator fights and mock battles that happened on land, they had special facilities to actually fill up a moat with water and have ships in there and stage mock naval battles complete with real blood.
Now, the water pipes that carried the water is one of the interesting stories that you write about in the book. Is they actually gave rise to the word plumbing. How do we get the word plumbing exactly, David? It's a little scary thought.
Well, plumbum is a Latin word for lead, and so these were lead pipes. Not all the Roman pipes were lead. Some of them were made out of terracotta, and they even had a form of cement that they used for some sections of the aqueducts. But lead was a wonderful material because it could be found in almost a pure form, melted down, and formed into all kinds of shapes. And maybe more importantly, it could be made watertight. And so it wouldn't leak when it was used underground. And if you needed to create an inverted siphon to get water to flow over a mountain pass. You could actually put all the water in the aqueduct through bundles of lead pipes and use the idea of a siphon, like the way we could siphon gasoline out of a gas tank, as a way to get water to flow up and over hills without having a mechanical pump.
So it sounds like a perfect vehicle to carry water, right? Except for that little thing where it's a potent neurotoxin and it can, you know, kill you over time.
There are some scientists who've had this theory that the fall of Rome was due to exposure to lead, and you could say that all of the Emperor Nero and all the things that went wrong with the Roman Empire was related to lead poisoning. But if the Romans were poisoned by lead, it was probably the lead they used to sweeten their wine, because the lead never reached high concentrations in their drinking water, because they fortunately lived in a place with a lot of calcium carbonate in the local geology. So the limestone in the local geology actually protected them from lead poisoning, because the levels of calcium and carbonate in the water were high enough that they got a thin film of calcite or limestone depositing on the inner surfaces of the pipes. And that meant that the water, even though it was flowing through a lead pipe, was flowing through a lead pipe that was coated with an inert mineral. And so it never built up to high concentrations in their drinking water. Now, their wine and their food may be another story.
Nothing like lacing your wine with a little bit of lead to make it a bit sweeter. We're talking with David Sedlak. Water 4.0 is his book, The Past, Present, and Future of the World's Most Vital Resource. In a bit, we're going to be talking about how Connecticut gets its water today and whether or not we need a new system to get water in our state. We'll also be checking in with West Virginia, where so many people have been affected by a chemical spill there. You can join us at 860-275-7266 if you have questions or thoughts about our water supply and what can be done to improve it. Well, we've been talking about water 1.0 in the Romans. Maybe you can take us through these three water revolutions and why you decided that that's the way we needed to not only write this book, but also define human history with water.
Sure, John. So we could think about the Romans as being a great moment in water, and it was because it was a city of close to 1 million people. But after the fall of the Roman Empire, in the Western world, cities became a lot smaller. And so you could go back to using buckets and wells to acquire your water. So with the exception of some monasteries and some small cities, no one really was building imported water systems or messing around with pipes to bring water into their cities. But all of that changed around the time of the Industrial Revolution, because all of that economic activity meant that cities started getting bigger and bigger. And so in the 19th century, when London started growing and eventually surpassed a population of 1 million, or when Paris started growing in the maybe mid-1800s, they had the same problem that the Romans faced. Namely, there were so many people and there wasn't enough water in the local area. So they turned back to water 1.0 also. So you can see in the middle of the 19th century, the British bringing in imported water supplies from miles outside of London, and the French engaging in a big project to replumb the Seine to bring water in to the city. And everyone did just fine with water 1.0 until the turn of the century. So what happened was people had water, and if there was contamination in it from upstream sources of sewage or pollution, they just built a new water supply and everyone was fine. Mm. But starting in the early part of the 20th century, we started to have cities close to one another. And so the upstream city would discharge their waste into the river and the downstream city would end up drinking it. And that resulted in transmission of waterborne diseases like cholera and typhoid fever. And so the example that I use in the book are the towns of Lowell and Lawrence on the Merrimack River in New England. And these two towns in Massachusetts, they were modestly small by today's standards. They were only about 50 to 100,000 people. But in their day, they were some of the biggest cities in America. And the problem was that Lowell discharged its waste, its sewage, into the Merrimack about 10 miles upstream of Lawrence. And that meant that people in Lawrence had exposure to typhoid fever, and they had some very big typhoid fever outbreaks in the 1890s. And since they were unable, due to their geography, to bring in a new source of imported water, they had to turn to a risky technology of drinking water treatment. And so Massachusetts hired some engineers from MIT to develop a drinking water treatment plant at the Lawrence Experimental Station. And that drinking water treatment plant made it safe to drink the sewage-contaminated water out of the Merrimack River. And the way it worked was by passing water through a sand filter. And in that sand filter, you got microbes growing on the surface of the filter, and the microbes trapped the typhoid fever bacteria and made the water safe to drink. So that technology of drinking water filtration, and then the later discovery that you could put chlorine in water to kill bacteria and other waterborne pathogens, created a very potent system of drinking water treatment, which solved a huge problem of typhoid fever. So within a period of about 20 or 30 years near the turn of the century, the problems of typhoid fever almost disappeared completely. And the lifespan of the average American increased by somewhere around 15 years just due to all the exposure to waterborne diseases that they no longer had to face. And so this second revolution in water, which I call Water 2.0, made it possible to drink water even if an upstream community was dumping its sewage into a river.
Before we get to this idea of Water 3.0, it seems as though part of the thing that drives the change, drives the technology, is our need to do two things: to find safe drinking water, of course, and then to dispose of waste. How much has the disposal of waste over time driven us toward new developments, toward new technologies? Because when we first think of water, David, almost everyone thinks of making sure they can drink it clean from the tap, but we hardly ever think about flushing the toilet and where it all goes. And that's, I think, more than anything else in your book, I learned that's what seems to have driven all these revolutions in technology and thought.
Right. We skipped right by the Romans and their sewers. So the Romans, after they brought all this water into the city, 100 gallons per person per day, they had to put it somewhere. And so initially they just let it flow into the streets, and that became inconvenient. So they dug channels and canals, and that got rid of it. But then that became inconvenient because you had these channels running through the city. So then they covered them up, and they created the sewers, or cloaca, of Rome. And that idea is also part of Water 1.0. You bring water in, you import it, and then you put it in an underground sewer, and you just send it to the lowest point near your city, which is usually a river or into the ocean, and you forget about it. So in the 19th century, when cities like London and Paris started growing, or New York, or Lowell and Lawrence, they used the same approach the Romans did. They put the water into sewers. But there was a difference. And that is that in the second half of the 19th century, we had steam engines and water wheels, which allowed us to deliver pressurized water directly into homes. So the Romans just relied upon gravity. You could go and get water from a fountain and bring it into your house. But suddenly, in the Victorian age, we had pressurized water, and pressurized water made possible the invention of the toilet. So with pressurized water, suddenly you could get rid of the outdoor latrine and bring the water closet into the house. That's why it's called a water closet. You didn't have a room in the house dedicated to it, so you took a closet and you put the toilet in there. And so suddenly we had all of these human wastes that were being diluted with huge quantities of water, and we put them in the most convenient place, the sewer. So the sewer, before the pressurized water delivery systems, the sewer was really just where we had drainage water from rainstorms and excess water that we had coming into our homes. But once we had the flush toilet, we had this contaminated waste going into sewers, and that's what went into the rivers and caused the problems that they experienced in Lowell and Lawrence.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to look more into Water 3.0, and then we're going to go forward in David Sedlak's book, Water 4.0, what's happening now with the changes in our climate, with the huge population growth in urban areas and even spreading into suburban areas. We're also going to be talking about Connecticut's water system and how it works. If you want to join us with questions and thoughts, 860-275-7266. You can email where we live at WNPR.org or tweet us at where we live.
This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about water and the systems that bring us our water. David Sedlak is author of Water 4.0, The Past, Present, and Future of the World's Most Vital Resource. He joins us today from Berkeley to talk about where these systems came from, where they stand now, and in a bit where they're headed. We're also joined in studio today by Virginia DeLima. She's chief of the USGS New England Water Science Center's Connecticut office. Virginia, good to see you once again. Welcome back to Where We Live.
Thank you, John.
We're going to talk a bit about Connecticut's water system and maybe some changes that are coming to it. But first, I'd like you to respond a bit to what you've heard from David Sedlak so far. What about the history of our water systems makes you think about the water systems that we have today?
Well, what strikes me is that very little has changed since the Roman times. We're still bringing water in from remote places into a centralized location. We still have the waste issues to deal with. And so it's sort of ironic that so many years have passed and we really aren't doing things in a particularly different way.
When was the last big water revolution in Connecticut? I mean, the systems that we have right now that bring us our water were built when? 1920s? Earlier part of
the... Some of them even earlier.
Yeah.
That's one of the challenges that the water providers have, that the aging of the infrastructure, the pipes, and to bring the water into the city.
But of course, infrastructure like that, it's not cheap. It's not easy to replace. I mean, it's not just changing out one pipe here or there. It's digging up miles and miles of pipe. It's completely overhauling the way we do everything.
That's right. And so it's very difficult. It's very expensive. It's very hard to integrate into regular operating procedures. Some of the companies do it very well. Some of the other companies are challenged in terms of maintaining that infrastructure.
David, before we go to some Connecticut issues, I'd like to have you walk us up to the present day here and just talk about this last period of history that we've been in so far. You know, now we're treating sewage. We have different ways of being able to get water to us. What do you consider to be the present of water right now, the water 3.0 before we get to this next revolution?
Sure. So we left off talking about water 2.0, this idea of drinking water treatment, and it allowed us to consume water that was contaminated with sewage, but it didn't really do anything to treat the sewage itself. And so over time, as cities got bigger and bigger, there was another problem posed by all of this sewage going into the environment untreated, and that was that when you put raw sewage into rivers, it damages the river. And so all of the organic wastes in the sewage would be used up by bacteria. And when the bacteria used the waste up, they would breathe in all the oxygen and take it away. And when the oxygen disappeared, the fish would die, the crabs would die, and the shellfish would die. And the other problem with putting all the sewage into rivers is it was chock full of nutrients. And so all the nutrients going into the river would fertilize algae. So further downstream, you'd get massive algae blooms and slime growing in the water. And so in a period from the 1930s through the Second World War, the rivers and estuaries in America became places where you wouldn't want to go. They just smelled horrible. They had dead fish and they weren't attractive places to be. And so in the post-war period, people talked a lot about the problem of all of this sewage going into rivers. There was a lot of hand-wringing about the dying of the Great Lakes and the Potomac River and the Hudson River and how polluted they were. But no one could develop the political will to do anything about it. And so we go forward to the 1960s when America became more conscious of environmental problems through things like Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring. And maybe more importantly, the iconic moment when the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland caught on fire. And so when the Cuyahoga River caught on fire in 1969 and the news crews showed up, the public finally just got fed up and decided it was time to do something about water pollution. And what they did was they turned to sewage treatment plants. So between the beginning of the 20th century and the 1970s, we had built sewage treatment plants. We'd built rudimentary sewage treatment plants to alleviate the worst problems associated with sewage. But with the Clean Water Act and its passage in 1972, the federal government agreed to underwrite the cost of modernizing the rudimentary sewage treatment plants that existed throughout America. And so we went on a building boom of about 15 or 20 years when the federal government paid about three-quarters the cost of building sewage treatment plants. And the sewage treatment plants built in the 1970, which I would call Water 3.0, made many of our rivers fishable, swimmable, and drinkable again. And that's really where we stand today.
I want to get to some of your phone calls at 860-275-7266 as we talk about water, our most precious resource. We're going to go to the phones. Mary's calling from Hartford. Hi, Mary. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. I'd like to ask David and Virginia about how to develop the 4.0 relationship between a colossal centralized treatment system such as the MDC Clean Water Project and measurable green infrastructure, which is the decentralized systems that could be implemented and added into that centralized if the funding became available in Connecticut.
Mary, thank you very much for your question. And first of all, Virginia, maybe you can explain a bit this MDC Clean Water Project that Mary's talking about, something we've spoken about on the program before, but for people who don't know what she's talking about, what is it?
One of the big issues with the metropolitan areas in New England with the older infrastructure is they have what they call combined sewer overflows, which means that the storm drains that take the rainwater that falls on the streets gets mixed with the sewage that is also flowing through the pipes. And when it's dry, that's not a problem because it all goes to the sewage treatment plants, even on a small rainstorm. But when there's a major rainstorm, that system, the sewage treatment system, is overwhelmed by the volume of water. And so some of the rainwater, including the raw sewage, gets dumped directly into the rivers. And so one of the things that the MDC is trying to do in the Hartford area is to separate those two systems so that we don't get these overflows of sewage going into the rivers.
So now to Mary's question, talk about this idea of, you know, if you had the funding, how do you link up these two things, this big system that's top down, and then also other ideas that are potentially more sustainable systems that we'd like to integrate?
Well, one of the things that you need to do is reduce the volume of water that's actually going in through the storm systems. And part of the MDC process is that there are some communities in the Hartford area where the storm drain, the roof drains, actually go right into the sanitary sewers. And so that's a lot of volume of clean water that is being added and has to go to the treatment plant. So in many neighborhoods, they're separating that out so that your drain pipe from your roof goes onto your lawn and percolates into the soil. So by reducing the volume, you help address that problem. A lot of people are talking about low-impact development and green infrastructure where you have swales that collect the rainwater and make it percolate into the ground. All these things are ways to reduce the volume that needs to go through the system.
David, do you have any other thoughts about Mary's question?
Yeah, I do. Cities have struggled with this problem of combined sewer overflows for the past couple of decades now, and there really are two schools of thought about how to alleviate them. The big engineered approach would be just to build massive bypass tunnels that are capable of holding all of that water and taking the clean water around the sewage treatment plant. But the approach that Virginia is talking about, the green infrastructure approach, it involves doing things like putting in green roofs and rain gardens and bioswales and cisterns. And that approach has the potential to be more cost-effective than this building massive tunnels for water. But it really needs the buy-in from the community and also the political support at the highest levels. So I look to cities like Philadelphia, where Mayor Nutter has really put a lot of effort into integrating green infrastructure, not only to solve the CSO problem or combined sewer overflow problem, but to make the city a more attractive and pleasant place to live. And I think we can see examples of other cities like Indianapolis and Seattle, where we can learn from their experiences of taking this alternative green infrastructure approach.
Virginia?
I think Bridgeport is taking the lead in the state of Connecticut and doing a lot of that type of thing.
Well, one of the things that it strikes me, we do a lot of programs about transportation. We do a lot of programs about energy. And the same issue, I think, David, seems to come up over and over again in the world of funding transportation. You need to repair roads because lots of cars drive on the roads, but you want to invest in public transportation so we don't need so many cars. In the world of energy production, you want to invest in renewables, but right now, you know, we burn a lot of coal, we burn a lot of oil and natural gas, and so we have to continue to have a supply. It almost seems as though water is in the same catch-22. We have to repair these older systems, these legacy systems, so where will we find the money to invest in this next big thing?
Well, there's a big difference. There's one other difference, John, and that is unlike transportation and energy, there's a public health risk associated with failing. And so if you don't have systems that you're confident will work, you could, first of all, waste a lot of money that you could use in the conventional manner, and you might make a bunch of people sick. And so some of these new technologies really need extra patience and extra attention before the engineers feel comfortable recommending them over the tried and true centralized approaches.
Here in Connecticut, we do have some built-in protections against some of those health risks, in that by law we cannot take a drinking water supply from a waste-receiving stream. In other words, we don't have the same situation that David was talking about earlier of one city being downstream from another and having to use water that includes the wastewater of the upstream community. So in Connecticut, our water is taken from the headwaters, the smaller streams around the state, and then the sewage discharges and industrial discharges are on the main stems of the river. So that is one step in protecting us against these health issues. At the same time, though, it makes a lot of challenges because we are excluding all of our big rivers, like the Connecticut, the Housatonic, the Thames, from a water supply. And so even though we assume that we are a water-rich state, that is difficult because we are looking at the small streams for our surface water supplies.
And, of course, one of the major rivers in the state, the Housatonic River, has long been polluted by downstream PCBs coming from a General Electric plant up in the western part of Massachusetts. It's a place you can't even really eat the fish from. We have this industrial legacy of many, not only Connecticut, but New England rivers here, Virginia.
That's correct. But as I said, here in Connecticut, that's less of a problem for drinking water. Now, groundwater is not included in that law, so that there are wells along some of our larger rivers, and some of the water going to those wells is coming out of the rivers.
We're talking about water today in the program, how we get it, where we might be going with our water systems. We're talking with Virginia DeLima from the USGS New England Water Science Center's Connecticut office, and with David Sedlak, whose new book is called Water 4.0. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Mike is calling from Bloomfield. Hello, Mike. Go ahead.
Hello, John. Thanks for this great discussion, really valuable and important. I was very happy to hear both Virginia and David talk about the importance of cisterns for collecting excess rainwater. This is something that I'm wondering if UConn has considered, with all the rooftop space that they have and their water needs, they've considered incorporating a cistern system. Also, Virginia mentioned the importance of green space, healthy turf grass for collecting runoff and rainwater, and the filtration system. David mentioned earlier about sand being a great system of cleaning and filtrating water. It occurs to me, and I wish the speakers would talk a little more about the importance of those green space areas, such as golf courses, playing fields, large areas of really healthy turf grass, and what that does for our water.
Mike, thank you very much. Virginia?
It's great that we have these open spaces where the rainwater can percolate naturally in. That nothing is simple. Everything is complicated because often you have issues of fertilizer and pesticides being used on those open spaces.
The very first thing, when I heard about golf courses, I know two things that go on golf courses. One, a lot of fertilizers to keep that grass very green. Another thing is they tend to attract these permanently resident Canadian geese that then foul the water systems right there on the golf courses where they eat all the grass.
That's right. That's right. You have to be careful when you walk around in some of these areas.
You do, and it's not good for the runoff either. These are some of the challenges that we're talking about here. Before I get to the next question that I wanted to with Virginia, David, do you have any more thoughts about that? About other systems that we could be adopting, maybe ourselves in our own communities, that might help this overall idea of preserving water, keeping more safe drinking water available?
Well, I like the idea of having more open spaces in cities where groundwater recharge happens, and you correctly point out that you have to be careful about the activities that happen on those surfaces. But in my world, when we hear about people wanting to build more golf courses or expand the amount of space for lawns, we worry about how much water that consumes. And so, you know, a lawn consumes a lot of water, and in the western United States and in the southeast, about half of the water use happens outdoors just to keep green lawns. And so for you in New England, it might be fine because you don't need irrigation. But for us in the West, the idea of using lawns as a way of recharging aquifers has a lot of negative consequences.
Yeah, watch a golf tournament from the desert sometime, those blimp shots, and you see the green spaces inside those just large swaths of desert, and you think, there must be an awful lot of water being dumped on there on a daily basis to make that happen. Well, one of the things that David points out, and this is maybe our thought process, which I want to get into, Virginia, is that here in the Northeast, we don't have to irrigate the same way. We assume that we have a water supply that is somewhat limitless compared to California in the middle of a drought right now, compared to a place like West Virginia, where we'll hear from in a moment, where one contamination catastrophe can cause so many problems. Do you think, Virginia, that we're thinking about our water wrong here in New England? Are we in more peril at it running low on this resource than maybe we think on a daily basis?
As you mentioned at the very beginning of the program, I think most people aren't thinking about water most of the time. We have a lot of water here. The challenge is that we don't always have it where we need it or when we need it. This has been brought to the public's attention just within the last year because of the issues with UConn wanting to bring needing more water on their campus. And one of the options was bringing water from the MDC system, which is in the Farmington Valley. And there was a lot of objection to that. And so that issue really got the attention of people across the state, not only the general public, but the politicians. And so people are thinking about it and trying to develop a water plan. We have been talking in Connecticut about water planning for 50 or 60 years, and we have not had the momentum to do it. Now, with this interest, is an opportunity to actually perhaps do it. And why I say it's so good that we have this issue surrounded by UConn is because normally it takes a drought or some natural disaster to get that kind of public attention, and you don't want that to happen, and yet at the same time you want people to have the attention. So now we have the attention because of the UConn need for more water, and I think now is a good opportunity to do that. One of the things I think that we need to look at is what have been the obstacles to implementing the water plans, the water thoughts that have been going on for these decades, because there have been a lot of good ideas out there. The Water Planning Council was initiated a little over 10 years ago, and just by its very name, you can see what they were supposed to be doing, and yet it hasn't happened. And so I do think now with this attention, we can start identifying those obstacles and perhaps addressing them.
What are the impediments? I mean, I assume it has something to do with local parochial interests. I mean, the problem with water is it flows from one community to the next, regardless of whether or not there's a town boundary there. That can certainly cause problems. The fact is that we have very small states here in New England. Maybe some sort of a regional water plan is better than a plan for just tiny little postage stamp Connecticut.
That could be a possibility. Each of the states have different plans because they're based on the local state laws. As I mentioned earlier, we have a law that we can't take water supply from a waste-receiving stream. That's unique. And that's very different from our neighbors, so it would be hard to do. But mentioning the small towns and the home rule is certainly an issue because economically each town is independent. They're dependent on their own tax base. And if you start saying, well, we should only be doing development in areas where there is water, that creates a situation where there are winners and losers. If you start looking at a larger area of planning, development, and sharing resources, you would be less likely to have such dramatic winners and losers.
Well, David, what can we in the Northeast learn from the West? I mean, you have these real, honest-to-God needs. What sort of lessons can we learn about the way you plan around your water resources?
Well, in California and in Texas and in Florida, water planning is done at the state level because it's so important to the economy. And that allows for more cooperation, and it allows the state to try to spur some innovation. But we suffer from many of the same problems, that water supply and water planning is done at the local level, and the ratepayers are the ones who live in the community, and they're not going to fund a project in someone else's community. So it's an endemic problem in the United States that we have this very fractured water governance that prevents us from doing things that make a lot of sense at the state or federal level.
We'll go to some phone calls here as we talk about our water resources with Bob in Hamden. Hi there, Bob. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Doing good.
I just wanted to speak to the issue of having a regional water plan. I live in Hamden, and we have a very good zoning system that any new development is required to mitigate water runoff so it doesn't go into storm drains, which is all good. But at the very same time, we're embroiled with the United Illuminating Company who is in the process of wanting to cut down all the street trees in Hamden and in their electrical grid to protect the electrical infrastructure. And the problem with that, of course, is these trees do a great job at mitigating stormwater runoff because they keep the water in the trees and let it slowly migrate down to the soil below, which is a very good thing. So this is just a case where we have two kind of opposing views that aren't connected and causing big problems.
Bob, it's a great point. And Virginia, those are just two of many different opposing views where the needs of energy, the needs of growth, of urban development, you know, come in stark contrast to our water needs sometimes.
Very true. And as I said, it's complicated. There are no easy answers. If there were easy answers, things would have happened a long time ago. I'm certainly not in a position to be able to judge whether the needs of UI versus the needs of the water infiltration, which one of those is greater. But it is certainly something that needs to be discussed.
I want to go to Richard in Southbury. Hi, Richard.
Yes. I think that it's a tremendously important topic, but one of which I think has not been addressed yet. That is, the rivers in Connecticut and throughout much of the U.S. are bordered by septic systems connected to houses or businesses, and that some of that water is incompletely treated and then seeps into the rivers, and that's what one of the reasons why I think we have such problems with river water quality in much of the U.S., and I wonder how this can be addressed.
That's dealing with what we refer to as non-point sources of contamination, which can come from septic systems, privately owned septic systems, is a much bigger challenge than dealing with the sewage treatment plants. Because if you know where the pipe is and things are concentrated, it's much easier to deal with it. So we do what the caller says is a very real problem, not only along stream banks but across the state, because we have a lot of small septic systems. It's important that the homeowners know that they have a responsibility to maintain those systems so that they're working as well as they possibly can. A well-working system is going to take care of the bacteria in an appropriate way. The larger concern is often chemicals that are dumped down the toilet, whether it be oils or cleaning products or whatnot. Those are typically not addressed in the septic system and can move through the groundwater into the rivers.
A quick call from Tony in West Hartford. Hi, Tony.
Hi. A personal initiative, I think. When you think about the amount of water that people use to use garbage disposals to flush some parings down the sewer that could otherwise be composted, I think there ought to be an outright ban on garbage disposal units.
So Tony is leading a one-man charge here. David, I'm sure that's one of many things that you've heard about as we sort of transition to this Water 4.0 idea and things that we can do, talking more about changes we can make moving forward. What do you think of his idea? And maybe you can give us a couple others.
Well, Tony, if we go back in history, in the 1940s, General Electric invented the garbage grinder to alleviate a disease outbreak that happened in Kansas because people were leaving their garbage in the streets. And so the original idea was that we'd put all of our garbage into garbage grinders and send it to the sewage treatment plant. And in some parts of the country, people are actually turning back in that direction because all of these organic wastes have energy in them. So here in Oakland, where I live, our local sewage treatment plant is bringing in restaurant waste and waste from wineries and slaughterhouses and putting it in a device called an anaerobic digester and creating biogas and using that biogas to run turbines. And our treatment plant doesn't consume any electricity because it turns that organic waste into energy. So I would say that, you know, in many cases, putting vegetable peels into the sewer and using a garbage disposal may cause a problem and make the sewage treatment plant work harder. But we could also think about it as an opportunity to turn our sewage treatment plants into energy recovery facilities. And so our future may see us putting even more of our wastes into the sewer because we're going to recover the energy and the nutrients and the water in it.
You also write about the ways in which we can separate the different sorts of things we put down the sewer, you know, whether or not we grind up vegetables and put them down a garbage disposal, or whether or not we use the toilet for human waste, or whether or not we, you know, decide to use water for washing our car. There's a number of different ways in which we can then take that water and perhaps separate it, Dave, so that it makes a little bit more sense in reusing it in some way?
If we didn't have to start with an existing system, we might do things quite differently. So if we were starting over from scratch, we might keep the black water, that is the water from the toilet, separate from the gray water, the water that goes through the washing machine and dishwasher. And that would give us tremendous opportunities to separate the water that might have the waterborne pathogens and chemicals in it from water that only needs a little bit of treatment before it could be used for irrigation or some other purpose. But the fact of the matter is that the cost of retrofitting our whole waste collection system to separate gray water from black water and maybe even yellow water, collecting our own urine, that right now isn't very attractive in built-up cities. So maybe future growth will see many different types of waste being collected, and that will make it much easier to recover the nutrients and the water and the energy.
I think if you want to make it more attractive, you got to come up with a better term than yellow water. I don't think anybody's going to buy into that. We're talking with David Sedlak, whose book is Water 4.0. Also, Virginia DeLima is here, chief of the USGS New England Water Science Center's Connecticut office. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll spend a few minutes with reporters on the ground in West Virginia to talk about what happened in the Elk River chemical spill and what's happening right now there. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, of course, in this race for governor, we'll once again be talking about the state budget. We're going to listen back to a panel discussion we held earlier this week with the Metro Hartford Alliance. Among the panelists was Ben Barnes, Governor Malloy's budget chief, and the Connecticut Mayor's Keith Faniff. We're going to find out about the state of our budget and how we look moving into the future. You can join the conversation coming up on the next Where We Live. Today, we're talking about our water systems. At a congressional hearing, Republican Representative Shelley Moore Capito asked the head of Charleston's water company, West Virginia, just a very simple question.
Is the water safe to drink?
As a water company, we don't set the safe standards, but we are in compliance with all the standards set by the health-based agencies.
Dr. Tierney, is the water safe to drink?
Everybody has a different definition. Am I confident in the science? I'm as confident as I can be, given what we had.
Yeah, so that's the Representative Capito asking the Commissioner of West Virginia's Department of Health and Human Resources the same question. I want to bring in some folks from West Virginia Public Radio, our friends Beth Voorhees and Dave Mistich, who've been covering this story about the Elk River chemical contamination. And Beth and Dave, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John. It's good to be here.
I'm wondering if you can quickly just lay out for our listeners what we know actually happened to the water supply there.
Well, there was a spill of about 10,000 gallons of a chemical called MCHM. Also combined with that, we found out later, was a chemical called PPH. They have long names that I can't pronounce. But basically, they're chemicals that are used in the coal processing. They wash the coal. When coal comes out of the ground, it comes with a lot of debris and dirt. And so it's washed in this chemical so that it can be sold to market. And 10,000 gallons spilled into the Elk River. The West Virginia Water, the West Virginia American Water Company, their water intake valve was downstream of this Freedom Industries chemical storage facility. And when that stuff leaked into the water, it got into the water plant, and that made the water unusable.
And it's been unusable for many people, some 300,000 people in total. Dave, is the water drinkable in that area now? And what are people saying? Are they worried about what's still in their water supply?
Well, I would say that some people are worried. Some people are back to drinking water from the tap. I will let you know that there was a large tourism conference here in town just this week, and a lot of people in from out of town didn't seem to be worried about it. They lifted the do-not-use ban about anywhere from 4 to 10 days, depending on where you were in the affected region. Like I said, some people are drinking the water. Some people, however, are not. There are even people that are reporting certain health symptoms such as rashes and things like that, but there has been absolutely no confirmation that the tainted water contributed to those symptoms. So,
Beth, tell us about the conversation that this has prompted in West Virginia about the ways that you can protect the water supply and really where the culpability is in such a terrible, terrible spill.
Well, our legislature is in session. The session began just before the water was contaminated. And the Senate took quick action. They introduced Senate Bill 373, which would require owners and operators to register their storage tanks with the Department of Environmental Protection, provide detailed information about what's in the tanks. The DEP will be required to permit the construction and maintenance of above-ground storage tanks and annually inspect these in storage tanks. Now, the Senate passed this bill very quickly, in about 10 days. It went over to the House of Delegates, and we're in the last, almost the last week of the session, and the House Judiciary Committee is looking at it now. The Senate was very disturbed that the House was going to put it through three separate committees. Health, it's made it through there. Mm. But now it's in the Judiciary Committee with just a week left, and it's got one more committee to go in the House Finance Committee.
Boy, and so politics playing a role, of course, in this. We just have a little bit of time. So, David Sedlak, when you heard about this and you've written so extensively about water, what do you think we need to learn from this West Virginia spill?
Well, John, I think about this in the context of other chemical spills that have happened. So about 5 years ago, there was a spill in China that meant that the city of Harbin, with over 17 million people, was without water for a few days. And a decade before that, there was a massive chemical spill in the Rhine River when a chemical factory caught on fire. And these are like train derailments and industrial accidents and refinery fires. They're things that may happen in whenever we use chemicals, but our job is to make sure they happen once every 500 years, not once every 5 years. So I think the kinds of things that are being talked about now of increasing the enforcement and oversight of chemical use is really the way we need to address these problems.
Virginia, maybe you can talk about how we should feel in Connecticut about maybe protections that we have in place or maybe protections we don't have in place, something very similar happening here.
Well, as David said, it's very hard to it could happen anywhere, and it can be in all sorts of different forms. We do have railroads and highways that are right along our riverways because it's flat and it's easier to build them there. And so there's always that threat. And the comment that he just made in terms of doing the inspections and going to double-line tanks in some areas, all these things will help. It all comes down to a matter of resources. We could charge a state agency to oversee these kinds of things. They need to have the staff to be able to do those inspections. And I know that's something that's been a challenge for many years here in Connecticut.
And I know David Sedlak, in just the last minute we have left, you know, John Stewart, as he often does, got this quite right when he reported on this spill, talking about how concerned we were about the possibility of a terrorist attack, somebody actually putting something in our water supply. But when we poison our own water, it seems to be met with a slightly different eye by the American public. Do you think that we have a safe water supply for the most part, David, moving forward here in America?
Oh, sure. I mean, the water supply that we have in the United States is something to be proud of. It works 365 days a year, 24 hours a day. And things like the tragedy in West Virginia only happen on rare occasions. So, yeah, I definitely think we could rededicate ourselves to better monitoring to make sure we understand when these things happen and better management of our chemicals. But the water that comes out of your tap is usually safer than the water that you get out of bottles and many of the other things that you're exposed to in your daily life.
And we still drink a lot of water out of bottles. David Sedlak's book is called Water 4.0. He joined us today from Berkeley, California. Thank you so much for your time, David. I appreciate it.
Thank you, John.
Thanks also to Beth Voorhees and Dave Mistich from West Virginia Public Broadcasting. If you want to read more about this ongoing story, go to wvpublic.org. We're also linking through to their stories. You're hearing them a lot on NPR. Thanks to them. And also thanks to Virginia DeLima, Chief of USGS, New England Water Science Center's Connecticut office. Virginia, it's been very good to talk with you. It's your last day in the job, from what I understand.
That's correct.
Congratulations on a great career, and thank you very much for talking water with us here on Where We Live. I'm John Dankowski. Have a great weekend.